Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Counsel, my name is Tom Berry, and I represent Bellin Wrecking and Salvage Company, which is appealing a preliminary injunction that was issued by Chief Judge Murphy of the Southern District of Illinois. This case clearly arises from a labor dispute between the Laborers Union 100 and Bellin. Specifically, the union claims that Bellin violated the collective bargaining agreement when it laid off one of its members last November. Bellin disagreed with the union's interpretation of the collective bargaining agreement. The union at that point exercised its economic rights and began picketing and striking Bellin. Bellin likewise then at that point exercised its economic rights to hire replacement workers to fill in for the members of Local 100 that were now withholding their services. It's actually a fight between two locals of the same union. Yeah, Bellin is a St. Louis contractor and has agreements with the Laborers Local 110, which is in Missouri. Local 100 has jurisdiction over in Illinois. I'm not aware of the internal workings of the Laborers Union in terms of how they can resolve disputes between its member locals. Okay. But essentially, at that point, again, Local 100 began exercising its right under the law to strike Bellin. And that arrangement, where each side was following their respective legal rights, continued for approximately 2 months. At that point, Local 100 sort of switched strategies here, ran into St. Clair County State Court, ex parte and without notice to Bellin, and obtained a temporary restraining order specifically prohibiting Bellin from using any other individuals on the work project other than Local 100, which again was withholding its members from the project. At that point, Bellin immediately removed this action to federal court and promptly requested the district court to dissolve the temporary restraining order. The district court, rather than address that motion, instead seized upon Mr. Kernan's request that the court ought to conduct a hearing on extending to a preliminary injunction. And held a hearing on January 25th and promptly issued the preliminary injunction the following day. In the appeal before this court, we contend that the district court, in entering the preliminary injunction, failed to follow and comply with the rigorous standards under the Norris-LaGuardia Act. Specifically, Section 1 clearly and unequivocally states that the district courts do not have jurisdiction to enter injunctive relief in labor disputes. And again, there's no issue here that we had a labor dispute. Rather, the Norris-LaGuardia Act specifically recognized that any injunction can only be issued, quote, except in strict conformity with the provisions of this chapter, end quote. At that point, you need to turn to Section 7 of the Norris-LaGuardia Act, which in part requires the plaintiff in this instance, Laborers 100, to establish, first, that Bellin is acting unlawfully, second, that its act has caused substantial and irreparable injury to Local 100, and furthermore, that Local 100 lacked an adequate remedy at law. The district court, rather than following up the Norris-LaGuardia Act, only followed the Rule 65 standards for a preliminary injunction, and in that instance made a number of errors of law. Specifically, it addressed the merits of the underlying labor dispute between Bellin and Local 100. Second, it failed to determine whether or not the injury was substantial. Third, it failed, it erred as a matter of law when it concluded that the Local 100 lacked any remedy at law. And fourth, it erred when it concluded that the injury was irreparable. But there are a number of principles emanating from the Norris-LaGuardia Act that are essentially being violated in this instance. The Supreme Court in Buffalo Forge back in 1976 specifically recognized that while Section 301 of the Labor Management Relations Act authorizes a district court to address the merits of a collective bargaining agreement being breached either by a union or an employer, it lacked the authority to issue an injunction pending resolution of that dispute. The Supreme Court at page 409 specifically stated, quote, in the course of enacting the Taft-Hartley Act, Congress rejected the proposal of the Norris-LaGuardia's Act prohibition against labor dispute injunctions be lifted to the extent necessary to make injunctive remedies available in federal court for purposes of enforcing collective bargaining agreements. The Supreme Court went on in Buffalo Forge to recognize that to do so would, quote, cut deeply into the policy of the Norris LaGuardia Act. And the courts would then have to be required to hold hearings, make findings of fact, interpret the applicable provisions of the agreement in order to restore the status quo or otherwise regulate the conduct of the parties. And that's exactly what the district court did in this instance, and it did so to the error of the law. The Seventh Circuit, with Chief Judge Flom on the panel, specifically recognized in Burlington Northern Railroad Company, 793 Fed Second, 795, that to allow such a procedure would run the risk of mistakes, quote, that are apt to be made in the interpretation of other laws when judges must act on emergency requests in advance of full deliberation, end quote. And that's at page 800 of the decision. More recently, Chief Judge Flom and Judge Evans recognized last year in the Burlington Northern and Santa Fe Railway case at 376 Fed 3rd 675 that courts should hesitate to provide injunctive remedies for any breach of a duty owing under labor laws unless that remedy alone can effectively guard the plaintiff's rights. Moreover, again, back to these cases all seem to come out of the railway, but again, back to the 1986 Burlington Northern decision, the court there again recognized that the Norris LaGuardia Act specifically, quote, prevents the use of injunctions against economic self-help. And that's exactly what we had here. We had the labor union saying, both first to the state court and then to Judge Murphy, you need to order the defendants to stop using replacement workers, that they must only get the workers from us, which, again, they were withholding, as was their right. The district court, again, spent the entire amount of the hearing focusing not on the Norris LaGuardia Act, but whose interpretation of the collective bargaining agreement was correct. Again, the court recognized that there was a signed agreement and that there was a verbal modification. The court then went on to recognize that the parties disagreed as to what the verbal modification was, and then the court at that point essentially usurped the role of the jury by deciding that I find that the union's version of the verbal modification is more credible than the employer's. And again, I need to go back at that point to Justice Stevens' opinion while a member of this court in the Associated General Contractors case, which is cited in our brief, where Justice Stevens specifically recognized that the district court is not to get into the merits of the underlying labor dispute for purposes of determining whether or not injunctive relief is appropriate. Rule 65 requires there be a finding of success on the merits or likelihood of success on the merits. There is no such requirement under the Norris LaGuardia Act. So again, the courts are not supposed to spend any time on whose interpretation is correct. Again, that's to be left, in this case, to the jury in adjudicating the 301 allegations that Bellin breached the contract when it laid off the individual in question last November. Moreover, even if the court was somehow permitted to examine the merits of the disputed interpretation, the district court, in my view, compounded that error by only requiring the union to establish that it had, quote, a better than negligible chance of succeeding. Based upon that low threshold finding, the judge then justified injunctive relief prohibiting Bellin from exercising its right to use replacement workers in the event of a strike. Moreover, and again, it frankly would result in Norris LaGuardia Act being rendered a nullity, the court's analysis of whether or not the harm in this instance was substantial is non-existent. Again, the harm in this instance was one individual was laid off for one day. At that point, the union struck, which was their right. Mr. Green reluctantly agreed by questioning by the district court, that yes, we can figure out what monetary losses this individual suffered when he was improperly laid off for one day, and yes, we can easily calculate what the contributions would have been, you know, required after the individual was allegedly laid off improperly. The real error committed by the district court was then to go on that this injury was both irreparable and that there was no adequate remedy at law. Section 301 permits the union to, yes, and additionally under ERISA they could have an independent basis to recover any lost contributions that were not paid in accordance with the collective bargaining agreement. The district court, on the other hand, made a couple of fundamental errors. First, he concluded that the union had no that essentially Bellin had the absolute right to violate the agreement with impunity. That is flat out wrong. Section 301 provides the union with redress. You know, counsel for Local 100 concedes in their brief that certainly 301 provides the union with the right to seek redress for the violation of the collective bargaining agreement. The district court additionally erred when he went on to conclude that only specific performance, or really only the power to enjoin the hiring of replacement workers, was the only remedy available to the union. Again, that just simply was a flat-out wrong statement of law, which was, again, there was no citation to any case of authority by the district court when it made those observations. Finally, the district court concluded that the failure, it had to issue injunctive relief in order to address what Mr. Green testified would be the loss of the union's reputation that might occur if members somehow view that employers can violate the agreement. I would suggest that in every situation when either an employer or a union comes before this court and says the other side is not following the agreement, you need to enjoin them, that each side has that same feeling that the other side is not honoring the commitments it had negotiated in good faith. And again, those were specifically... Okay, thank you, Your Honor. At this point, I will cede the podium to Mr. Kernan.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Steve Kernan. I'm here on behalf of Laborers Local 100. If I may, I'd like to make one point right off the bat, and that is throughout this case, Bellin has argued that Laborers Local 100 had an adequate remedy at law, and therefore its harm was not irreparable. Local 100 submits that Bellin has made an admission on the record 180 degrees contrary. When this hearing started, we explained to the trial judge, Judge Murphy, that we've got the pleadings on file, they're verified for the petition. Instead of rehashing all that, can we just supplement the record with new materials and you consider what's already on file from both sides? He said he would. In their motion, or rather their memorandum in response to our motion for preliminary injunction, they cited the Sheet Metal Workers versus Hare Brothers case. Now, I'm not going to go into that. That's already done in the briefs. But they argued that this case was very similar to the Instant case. And they said, unlike the case at Barr, however, the collective bargaining agreement in Hare Brothers covered an indeterminate number of projects over the life of the collecting bargaining agreement, which could not be quantified with certainty over the entire life of the collective bargaining agreement. Thus, inasmuch as the court could not calculate with any sufficient degree of certainty how many projects the employer would have in the future and how many employees it would require for said future projects that remained during the remainder of the collective bargaining agreement, the court held that the damages were impractical and therefore there was no adequate remedy at law. With respect to the impracticality of the damages in the Instant case is distinguishable from Hare Brothers inasmuch as Bellin became a signatory to a collective bargaining agreement for the sole purpose of performing one job, their emphasis, whereas in Hare Brothers, the employer became a signatory to a collective bargaining agreement which covered an indeterminate number of jobs. This was filed 24 hours before the hearing. When they put on Don Bellin, he testified just to the opposite. He tried to make it a one-job agreement That was rejected. He signed up for a 3-year agreement, of which there was 1 year, 9 months left. And he testified that he had worked in their jurisdiction before, that he's worked in their jurisdiction, of course, now, and that there was a likelihood of him working in the jurisdiction in the future. So if for no other reason, the incalculability of future damages was... I'm sorry, Your Honor. Yes, sir, because you don't know how many... I'm sorry. Right. Well, yes, two laborers local. It's... I'm sorry. I suspect there might be if this was really a jurisdictional fight between the unions, which this was not. He happened to be using 110 laborers. There's a provision in the agreement, and I'm sure there's a like one over in St. Louis, that the way you do that is you get permission from both sides, you can bring your guys in. If they had Local 100 been over there? Yes, sir. Well, it is if you were fighting amongst each other. Our problem is he signed up. Well, what he had done is he had signed the agreement, Your Honor, for the collective bargaining agreement, and he turned his back on it entirely. The one-day layoff... But not that doesn't apply across the river to East St. Louis. I'm sorry. Well, the question of the layoff was, did it violate the agreement? And then, I know it's not. Well, you violated the agreement. The only agreement in question was the one with East St. Louis Laborers Local 100. That doesn't apply over here, though. Only with the permission of the Illinois business agent. Correct. And the only way an Illinois laborer could work over in St. Louis was with the permission of the St. Louis business agent. I assume under their national charter they would be with their international. But as I said, this is between the unions. He may be using... I assume they do. So if for no other reason 100 submits that the incalculability of the future damages showed an element of damages that was not subject to an adequate remedy. The other things that he has raised was in his brief was that 100 had not supported its argument with facts. As I indicated earlier, the pleadings and the briefs were all going to be considered by the trial judge. In its petition, its verified petition for a temporary restraining order, Local 100 raised the issue of the inability to bring a claim on behalf of its membership because of the difficulty in determining who is the appropriate plaintiff. Unlike a factory situation or an office situation where if something happens to one employee or several employees, they may work 30 years for a company. In construction business, if they work 30 days for the same employer, they're thrilled. So when he's going on ad infinitum and violating the contract, 100 didn't know how do you calculate who is going to be the appropriate plaintiff. They submit that's also an argument in support of their claim for an inadequate remedy at law. In 100's motion for preliminary injunction, they set forth the argument that it was going to be a fait accompli for their prayer for specific performance. All they wanted was Bell and Wrecking to comply with the contract that they voluntarily signed. This project had been going on for 8 months. It may well have been going on for another 10 months. It could well be completed by the time the court can ultimately hear the matter. Specific performance for a job that isn't in existence isn't much of a reward. In fact, it's a fait accompli. I've already addressed the incalculability argument. We raised in the briefs the health insurance argument that it isn't just, well, in fact, along those lines. The plaintiff cited a case, a Northern District case, for the proposition that an injunction shouldn't issue in labor disputes like this. Brotherhood of Electrical Workers versus Exelon. And I won't go into the actual case, but just summarize that was a factory situation, not a construction situation. It was only I'm sorry. Be subject to what, Your Honor? Well, our unique situation was unique is that it didn't have an arbitration provision or a grievance provision in there, for the better or the worse of it. So the only remedy is, presuming economic efforts don't work, is to bring a claim in court. It's equity. If you could calculate. Yes. Oh, I think, certainly, Your Honor, for instance, in a situation like the case that he cited, if you're in a situation where somebody's wrongfully laid off and it's a temporary thing for 30 days, for instance, in this case, if the only issue would have been this individual laid off for a day or two, they could make their claim at law because it's specific on what the damages would be. The concern of Local 100 was much more that this isn't just a layoff for one day. This is the contractor that completely turned his back on the contract. He was hiring no one from Local 100. He was complying with none of the provisions of the contract. That gets into the irreparable nature of the after the layoff and the strike, of course. The strike. Well, the question would be, I suppose, if it was a wrongful strike, then we're down to a claim for just damages for the layoff. The trial court found that the layoff was in violation and therefore the strike was a legitimate strike, so then the damages go beyond the layoff. It's a rejection of the contract in its entirety. Well, because he's got this job going on. He said he may have other jobs going on. If we make our claim now, how do we, as they said in the Hare Brothers case, we don't know how many contracts he's going to have in the future. We don't know how many laborers is going to be in the future involved in the job. We don't know how long the jobs will go on. So there's no way to, we can't, and by virtue of those reasons, can't determine who the plaintiffs would be. The union can't bring a claim for money damages without having somebody to be able to identify as its member that's injured. You have to have a proper plaintiff. They just can't award the money to the union itself and then to dole out as it saw fit. I'm sorry. It's the clearest argument for the for not having an adequate remedy is the future damages, which aren't calculable because we don't know what they are. The other one The argument that you can't bring a claim on behalf of one of the members was a serious concern of the unions. The biggest concern of the union, however, was just the walking away from the contract by the contractor. If he's the right of a union to organize and to collectively bargain is just at the core of their existence. And if a contractor is allowed to do that without an adequate remedy, which they contend they don't have, then there'll be several others that do it. And if several do it, there'll be a large group that does it. And before you know, their biggest concern is they have no real ability to organize and negotiate. Their membership will wonder what's the point. And that is the harm that was argued all along. The real issue with the union for irreparable harm was the harm to the union and its ability to organize and negotiate and then to have the meaningful results. I'm sorry? It is, Your Honor. It's the unique situation about this is that it wasn't just a temporary thing, a short layoff or a minor disagreement or something. This was a contractor that completely walked away from the entire agreement, every aspect of it. That's created what they submit as the irreparable harm, the shaking of the confidence in their ability to organize. For those reasons, the union believed that their harm was irreparable, and if nothing more, that the case was cited by Velen itself on future damages. Yes, sir. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors, and I will be brief. First of all, the Hare Brothers case is not applicable to the situation that we have here today. In the Hare Brothers, the employer had completely disavowed the entire collective bargaining agreement, and this is not a situation, despite Mr. Kernan's suggestion to the contrary, where Bellin said we're not bound by this contract. They just had a different interpretation of what the agreement was. You're absolutely right, Judge Bauer. The choice Bellin had was they either laid off the individual they did or they accede to Local 100 position that they had to lay off the member of Labor's Local 110. That was the union's dispute. You have to lay off the 110 laborer, not the 100 laborer. And that's what started the entire dispute in the first place. It's still ongoing. I honestly do not know when it's completed, as the court can imagine. It takes a while to tear down a bridge, so the project is still going on today. Additionally, the collective bargaining agreement, to respond to Mr. Curran's suggestion that Bellin would not violate its contract with Local 110, the specific provision of the 100 agreement that deals with having individuals from different unions on the same project, that's Section 1P, of the agreement at page 8 specifically says that has to be with the agreement of the business manager of both local unions involved. So again, Bellin was caught in between. They either violated the agreement with 110 or they violated the agreement with 100. Mr. Kernan suggesting that it would be impossible to calculate who was damaged or harmed by the improper layoff ignores the fact that the same two individuals worked for this job until they went on strike. Again, there's no Norris LaGuardia exception for construction industry. The union had the remedy above and beyond simply filing a 301 action. They had the ultimate remedy, which they used in this case, the ability to withhold their services and to strike. And then finally, again, to address Mr. Kernan's concern about not being able to calculate the damages, the best proof is who Bellin has used since they withheld their services. You can look at the time records, the payroll records, and that would allow you to calculate the damages. I see my time has elapsed, and I would request the court to reverse the district court, dissolve the injunction, and award Bellin its costs and fees for the improperly granted injunction. Thank you, Your Honors.